time for rebuttal?
Yes, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right, then we'll be glad to hear from you when you're ready.
All right. May it please the court, I'm Allison Carpenter on behalf of Mr. Mirones Ramos. In this particular case, there are factual issues that became a dispute in the nature of the appeal. We have a statement of facts, of course, as your honors know. And the Attorney General talked a lot about the standard that your honors review the evidence with. And so I'd like to point out a couple of things. One case, for example, that the Commonwealth cites, Haskins v. Commonwealth. And this is, we're discussing reasonable theories of innocence. And so my theory on this is that the Commonwealth failed to exclude all reasonable theories of innocence simply because the Commonwealth picked the theory that was the most obvious doesn't mean that they failed to exclude the other reasonable theories
of innocence. I think there's a lot of confusion about it. I mean, the case law, it seems to me, is pretty clear that on a couple of points. One is that the notion that the Commonwealth is required to exclude any hypothesis, any reasonable hypothesis consistent with innocence, simply translates into they have to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. That's number one. And number two, there's the principle that they're limited to the record. We don't speculate outside the record as to, you know, what a hypothesis of innocence might be. So where does that leave you in this case?
Well, I think in Haskins v. Commonwealth, they talk about the concept of equipoise, where if there are two competing theories, after the fact finder has resolved conflicts of fact, the
Let me put it more succinctly. In this case, we have two people live in a house. One comes home, and there's no car in the driveway. A matter of minutes later, his roommate comes home. There's a car in the driveway with an individual working on the car, changing the tire. Nobody sees him drive the car into the driveway. He's the only individual who's there. He's clearly intoxicated. Why is it unreasonable to conclude from the evidence, why is it unreasonable hypothesis, if you will, to conclude from that circumstantial evidence that he drove the car to get it into the driveway? He's the only one there. He's working on it. He's obviously, the engine, I guess, is warm, is the record. So, I mean, clearly wasn't there a matter of minutes before.
Well, a number of responses to that. One, regarding the engine being warm, the officer wasn't qualified as an expert to talk about car engines.
It wasn't objected to.
Correct. In the record, it wasn't objected to.
And so his statement that it was driven recently, it was his estimation that it was driven recently, was properly before the jury because it wasn't objected to.
But we do know, I think the statement of facts has a more broad view of the time frame. The first individual who came home said he got home around 8 or 8:30. And then we know that the second individual said he got home between 10 and 10:15. And then we know that the police didn't arrive until 11:10. So by the time the officer was even investigating, it had been well over an hour, at least, that the car was not driven or operated.
Well, but in that set of circumstances, that seems to me that goes more to your second assignment of errors than to your first, which is whether your client drove the car on a public roadway. Given all of the facts that Judge Humphreys asked you about, plus the fact that your client was reported to have made two statements. One, he told the residents of the residents that he had hit something, and then he told the police officer that he hadn't hit something. Can you think of any circumstance where somebody who was not the driver of the car explaining damage to the car would say, I hit something to explain the damage, or I didn't hit something to say, I don't know how the damage occurred? I mean, doesn't he have to be the driver?
Well,
normal English usage?
Well, I think that's the problem. This is a Spanish-speaking individual. And so all of the witnesses in this case who are testifying all acknowledge that he was a native Spanish speaker. The officer in particular said he was talking primarily in Spanish.
But isn't that for the jury to determine whether he understood what he was saying or not, not us?
Well, we don't know which facts the jury determined, you know, what were the relevant facts to the jury, but we do know that Spanish speakers have difficulty with pronouns, and so if
well,
they're
the relevant
saying
facts for us
things.
Are we have to take the evidence in the light most favorable of the party that prevailed, which is the Commonwealth. That's really, however the jury approached it, We're not in the jury room. We weren't in the jury room. We don't know how their deliberations went. But nonetheless, we know what the result was. And any facts and circumstances that support that result are the facts that we're bound by.
Well, someone, I guess, back to Judge Humphrey's question originally about how this car ended up in the driveway. Although there were two individuals who were who came and testified as being housemates, we do know from the record there were more individuals, and I'd refer Your Honors to page 40 of the appendix. There is a picture, and one of the individuals drew on the picture Tyler. So there's a picture of a car that says Tyler, and that was not the name of either individual. So we know there were at least three housemates. Also in the statement of facts, the first person who got home...
How does that help you?
Well, it just shows that this is a driveway that can accommodate numerous cars. There were two cars he showed where two cars were normally parked, and that doesn't include the second individual who testified. Additionally, the first individual never said that he, in the statement of facts, he did not say, "I didn't notice a car." It's just not there. The Commonwealth never indicated that Mr. Morones Ramos even had the ability to operate the car. There were no keys. There's no keys ever found. There's no inventory.
Well, you'll concede that the evidence established that the car was operated. What I understand your assignment of error to be, it didn't prove that your client operated it, but the car was not in the driveway and then was in the driveway.
It didn't fall out of the sky.
It had to have been operated by somebody.
Right, but the issue is that it's the Commonwealth's burden to prove who operated it. It wasn't my burden to prove that my client did not operate it. It was their burden to prove that he did operate it.
And that goes back to, is your best answer to the question of how do you get around the statement, "I hit something," is that he didn't understand what he was saying or he was misunderstood?
Well, the way that the statement was said in the statement of facts was, I think it says, he stated that he hit something. The recording is also a part of the record, and I believe in the recording it says, "I believe later he mentioned that he hit something." So that's a little weaker of a statement.
He also said, he also asked the I forget which of the residents asked him not to call the police, which is, again, in isolation maybe doesn't mean much, but in context with the statements that Judge Russell just alluded to, I mean, it seems to me that also indicates, or at least reinforces the notion that by saying I either hit something or didn't hit something, I was behind the wheel.
And if there's ambiguity between the recording and the statement of facts, don't we have to give any ambiguity? Don't we have to resolve it in the Commonwealth's favor given the standard of review?
Well, if there's an actual recording and it's part of the record, I think...
Well, there's an actual statement of facts that was signed off by your client's counsel, correct?
Yes, I was the counsel, so I participated. But the statement of facts that I wrote was different than the one that was ultimately submitted by the court.
Well, the one that was submitted by the court is the one we're stuck with.
Right. So I guess where it leaves us is that there's other cases, I think, Lyons and Overby, where there was a passenger in the car. And so let's say Mr. Overby, that's a case that I refer to a lot. Let's say that Mr. Overby was down in the woods where he said he threw his wine into the bushes. And when the police came, the passenger was there and the passenger was intoxicated. Putting Mr. Morones Ramos on the hook without any evidence that he was the driver, you could see a situation where the passenger would say, "We hit something," or something like that. Because the car hit something.
I think it's on page 23 of the joint appendix, but didn't your client ask Mr. Miller and Mr. Powers to allow him to leave his vehicle there? And what do we take from that?
Well, I think one of the problems, as well, is that we don't have direct quotes, and so it's characterization, and so...
Well, it's a statement of facts. It's in the statement of facts, and that's what we have.
Right, but it says, pleaded with them to let him leave the car there.
Right.
And the Commonwealth could have easily established that.
If he's not the driver of the car, why would he make such a statement? If he was just an innocent passerby who happened to be in the... he sees a car in a driveway and decides, "Well, I think I'll go ahead and change the tire. I'm a good Samaritan, I'm going to change the tire," which is, I guess, your theory of what must have happened here.
Well, I think that there are theories where he could have been taking responsibility for the car, but not as the actual operator of the car. And
but to follow up on Judge Humphrey's line of thinking, not a reasonable inference that could be drawn by the fact finder that he was in fact the driver or the operator of the motor vehicle?
No, I believe the jury was not reasonable in this case because they did not look at other theories. They're legal standards, and the jury disregarded those.
There's a difference between not looking at another theory and rejecting, looking at and rejecting another theory, isn't there?
Well, they could resolve. In this particular case, my argument is that they did not act reasonably because there were other theories on this case, and they were reasonable other theories, and they disregarded those and still found him guilty despite the absence of evidence. We also know that he presented his business card, but the Commonwealth didn't show that the car was registered, who it was registered to. In other cases, such as Lyons, that was an important factor showing that the individual there was with his registered vehicle.
Carpenter, you have 4 minutes left in rebuttal. Mr. Shandoval?
Good morning. May it please the Court. Chris Shandoval for the Commonwealth. As the Court has already noted, Mr. Morones-Ramos basically negated any possible theories or hypotheses of innocence by his own statements. And the circumstances, corroborating circumstances, corroborated those statements. He admitted, first of all, that he had been drinking. He told the two men that he was drunk. He also admitted that he'd been driving when he admitted that he had hit something. And then finally, when he told Officer Sense that he had not had his last glass of wine until 4 hours prior to the accident, that is also an admission that he had not had anything to drink since the accident, so he must have been drunk while he was
really
driving.
I don't think there's any serious contention that the appellant here wasn't intoxicated. I think the two fundamental factual issues in question are whether he ever drove there or operated the vehicle, and also whether or not the vehicle ever was operated on a public highway by him.
Right, and of course, as to the driving under the influence, the public highway is not an element of that offense. It is an element of the refusal offense. But like the court said in Lyons, in that case, it strained credulity to believe that Mr. Lyons ended up in the driver's seat behind the steering wheel of a car that had just rear-ended a parked car. It strained credulity to believe that he had not driven the car and yet somehow ended up in that exact situation. I think in this case it strains credulity to believe that Mr. Morones-Ramos and this vehicle ended up in the driveway in some other fashion than him driving it there, hitting something and then driving it there. And of course his statements that he had hit something disproves the hypotheses that are raised on appeal that perhaps someone else had driven the car and then he had been dropped off or strolled by in order to fix the flat tire and kind of abandoned to do that on his own.
On the refusal charge?
Yes, Your Honor.
What is the Commonwealth's position regarding whether the evidence was sufficient to establish that the car was driven within the time period relative to the arrest?
So he was arrested at 11:23 p.m. So 3 hours prior to 11:23 p.m. is 8:23 p.m. So the question is whether he could have stopped driving the car prior to 8:23 p.m. And of course, Mr. Miller's testimony was that he arrived home around 8 or 8:30, and that he didn't. The testimony was that he had no awareness that the vehicle was in the parking lot until he came back out later with Mr. Powers. So, in light most favorable to Commonwealth, if he arrived home at 8:30, then that makes it impossible for Mr. Morones-Ramos to have driven the car into the driveway prior to that time, and thus he was necessarily arrested within the three-hour window.
Given that the testimony, though, wasn't 8:30, it was a range. It was 8 to 8:30. Isn't the light most favorable to the Commonwealth that it was somewhere in the range of between 8 and 8:30 and not 8:30 itself?
No, I think the light most favorable is the most favorable reading of those facts, and the most favorable reading is 8:30. If you want to look further for corroborating evidence, I think the conclusion that Mr. Miller arrived home around 8:30 is corroborated by two facts, and not just when Mr. Miller arrived home, but more importantly, how recently Mr. Morones Ramos had driven the vehicle onto the driveway when Mr. Powers arrived home around 10 or 10:15. And those two facts are, first of all, the fact that when the officer got there at around 11, the engine block was still warm, and it was 11 o'clock at night in November. And of course, the trial court is entitled to use common sense to conclude that the vehicle block being still warm at 11 o'clock meant that he had been driving within 3 hours prior to that time. And then second of all, the fact that as the trial court relied upon, Mr. Morones Ramos appeared to still be in the early stages of attempting to change his tire. He managed to get it jacked up, apparently. He had not removed the bolts or the lug nuts. He had not even managed to get the spare tire out of the vehicle. And, of course, his impaired state seemed to be slowing him down quite a bit. And yet it was still reasonable for the fact finder to conclude that he had not been at this for 2 hours when Mr. Powers arrived home. That he had arrived in that parking lot more recently than that, and was still attempting to change the tire. And so those 23 minutes, if you take the light most favorable to him, which of course is not the standard, then it would have been 8 o'clock, so he's got 23 minutes.
Actually, only 22.
Or 22 minutes to get the car there to the driveway. And that, of course, is, as I said, is disproven by those other facts, the engine block being still warm around 11 and the fact that he was still in the early stages of changing the tire, which led the witness, Officer Sense, to conclude that he'd only recently driven the vehicle, and led the trial court to conclude that it was inconceivable that he had been there for 2 hours in the driveway attempting to change the tire at the time that Mr. Powers arrived home. So for those reasons, we would ask the court to affirm both convictions.
Thank you, Mr. Chandler.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Carpenter?
Thank you. To address the refusal issue and jump right into the light most favorable, the around 8 or 8:30 comment, I would refer to the Smith v. Commonwealth case, and that says that the appellate court should disregard the evidence of the accused in conflict with that of the Commonwealth. And I do not believe that 8 or 8:30 is a conflict. It's a phrase. And Mr. Miller, the person who said that, didn't say it, for example, on direct and then counter, you know, say 8:30 on direct and then say 8 o'clock on cross. He said one statement, I arrived home at 8 or 8:30. So that was not...
Basically, the Commonwealth, your position is the Commonwealth can't rise above the characterization of its own witnesses.
Correct. The fact isn't one fact in 8:30 or another. The fact is around 8 or 8:30. And so...
Well, please address some of the other evidentiary issue... revelations that might suggest that it didn't happen in the first 22 minutes of between 8 and 8:22, that the warm engine, the state of the repair of the tire being in the early stages.
Well, you know, tire repairs can be done in different orders by different people. I understand that, of course, the wheel was not actually off the car. It was clear that Mr. Morones Ramos was doing different things. For example, he was taking phone calls. He was speaking in Spanish with people on the phone. So it's not like he was on a mission to just get that tire off right away and get it back on. And I think that the individuals, they didn't call the police when Mr. Powers arrived at 10 o'clock. He didn't call the police because he thought there had been like an emergency or there had just been like an accident. The emergency signals didn't go off in his mind. He worked with Mr. Morones for about an hour before he even called the police, and at that point he called the non-emergency number.
Well, doesn't your best argument, you know, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, so feel free to disagree with me, but it strikes me in response to Judge Russell's question that your best argument would seem to me to be simply that the facts referred to by Mr. Chandoval, the state of the repair of the tire and the warmth of the engine hood or whatever it was, are not specific enough to eliminate a 22-minute discrepancy.
Well, I agree with that. There was, although the officer said the car could have recently, he speculated that the car had recently been on. He doesn't speculate whether it was an hour and a half ago, 2 hours ago, 2.5 hours.
I mean, the legislature's drawn a bright line and said 3 hours, essentially. And so, you know, the Commonwealth has to, at least to sustain that one particular offense, the Commonwealth has to establish that 3-hour window. and the evidence has to support that. And 2 hours and 59 minutes isn't good enough. So isn't that where we are there?
Yes, I do think it's a strict compliance. Also, although this doesn't help the first assignment of error, the DUI argument, if the car had been operated on the driveway, that wouldn't invoke, that wouldn't mess up the 3 hours, I guess. So another additional fact that could be included in looking at the second assignment of error is that if the car had been on in the driveway, then it would not have, it had to have been operated within 3 hours on a public highway, not just on a private drive. I don't think there's any dispute that it was a private drive, but that would be another fact. And I think that I do think that Mr. Morones-Ramos and Mr. Powers were going back and forth for a while. Mr. Powers said they talked for a while. He went inside. He came back out. Mr. Miller and Mr. Powers were there. And so I do think a lot of different things were going on. And so the time frame of the tire was not the end of the inquiry. Mr. Morones, for example, could have decided to abandon changing the tire once he realized there were two tires, and that wasn't going to fix the situation anyway. So I would ask your honors to reverse this. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll come down and recount.